The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome everyone to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted today to have with me special guest Judith McKenzie of Downing Fund Managers, one of the smartest investors in the city. Welcome, Judith.
Thank you, Paul. What an introduction.
I understand you struggled getting back from Scotland over the weekend on the ferry. Well, I'm a sort of value investor and a GARP investor, and my portfolio has been absolutely blown off course this year. How's Downing small and micro cap performed? How's it got on this year as well?
Oh, we've had a huge kicking as a value investor in the space that's been momentum led. And remember, we're investing in strategic investments, so that's taking between 3 and 25% of the underlying businesses. And we're doing that probably because there might be a little bit of self-help needed. So you do tend to have quite a J-curve in these types of companies. So yeah, we've got a value bias, and we've got companies that have needed a tweaking around the edges. So we're 3 years into the journey on a sort of 5 to 7 year plan with these companies. And yeah, in momentum markets, it's been a really tough place to be. So I share your pain.
And how do you ever question yourself in terms of the sort of the value GARP investing? Because I mean, when you get sort of people like Warren Buffett, known for his value, and he buys into the listing of Snowflake last week, which is at 100 times sales, and he's a sort of like the, you know, he's I'm not sure he's throwing in the towel, but he's definitely moving up the sort of the growth and price premium table. Do you ever sort of like think, well, maybe, you know, this is a tough game and we should sort of like look elsewhere?
In dark moments, yes, of course we do. But I think, I mean, my experience, I've been in microcap, small cap for, dare I say, 25, 26, maybe even 27 years. And having invested with that value bias, and I say value bias because, as you know, there's so many different definitions of value, and we're trying to buy growth at the right price, just as you are. And I think you've got to be very cognizant of market dynamics, and especially at the moment. I mean, we love widgets. A widget manufacturer in the Northeast is normally something that gets us really excited. But what we've tried to do, especially over the last sort of 6-12 months or so, is look at the trends, not wanting to buy something on NASDAQ at 33, 35 times earnings, but looking at actually how almost this kind of quasi-industrial revolution is changing things, and then actually going into our little unloved microcap space and trying to find opportunities. And actually there's some really interesting opportunities about the place. So I would always say, if you change your style, you then are misleading your investors, and that's the last thing you want to do. And also, fundamentally, it's a style that I'm comfortable with, I understand, and having been in this industry for so many years, I know it works. It does not work in momentum markets, and that's what we're seeing at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember a cast of my mind back to sort of 1995, I think it was, or 1996, and we had a guy called, I think it was a chap, CIO of Drew and Phillips, was it something? Tony Dye, was that his name?
Tony Dye at Phillips and Drew, who was my hero at the time, and I actually keep casting my mind back to him and how he was the absolute stalwart against anything growth at the time.
And I think, you know, there's a company as well.
Yeah,
that's right. But he was
really. Yeah, the push-up died just after he left his job. So, and then of course the value tilt suddenly happened. And you know, that's what I think. You look at the stats now, you've got such a correlation between momentum, growth and volatility. They're all correlated. That trade's all a plus one correlation. Then you look at good old value and it's negative one. You look back to the 1995, whenever it was, and when that there was the same kind of correlation, it tipped really quickly into value when markets changed and people woke up and realised that, you know, buying something where you're expecting that level of growth, or you're buying at 50 times earnings, just isn't sensible.
You know, what will be the trigger for that, Judith, do you think? I mean, is it going to be essentially a wake-up call? Is it going to be sort of like a vaccine, for instance, and that means that the sort of the work at home and the Zoom sort of stocks come off the froth, etc., and give the value guys a chance? Or is it going to be something, you know, different, just that sort of like people, because I mean, most of the actual business models, even though these stocks are priced to, I mean, just to give you an idea, I mean, I've sold other software stocks, and we used to always like look at price to earnings ratios, or peg ratios, that was it, of one. Well, actually, there's now a sales, you know, 10 times sort of like sales equates to sort of like 10% sales growth. So, you know, it's a frightening sort of valuation. But they are real businesses, a lot of these, even though they're not generating any money, but they are growing. And it's sort of like, it's quite a difficult one to sort of get your hand around. I mean, I've actually spoken to quite a few Silicon Valley guys, and they say you have to take a 3 to 5 year view, and that company will grow into its valuation, even if it's trading on 50 times sales.
Yeah, and I think you also have to take, learning from my experience from the last tech boom, you have to take a real kind of portfolio approach, because you're not, we're not scientists, we're not, I'm not 21 anymore. I know about apps and I know what I use, but you know, we're not the ones, that our demographic, we're not the ones that are driving the growth in some of these companies. So, you know, I really do like sticking to what I know. And therefore, if you are going to invest in that area, I think you do need to take quite a broad portfolio approach you know, be prepared to lose a few as well on the way.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hoping that the value investments come back in 2021. I always find that these things tend to go in phases. You have a couple of good years or 3 or 4 years, and then for some reason, there's a few things that just sort of like knock a few of the stocks. And if you run a concentrated portfolio, your idiosyncratic risk is that much higher.
Exactly. And yeah. Do you not think as well that you know the economic influences that we're facing and political influences that we're facing at the moment are you know, could be the catalyst for that tilt back into a bit more value?
We saw something like inflation.
Well, yeah, inflation, but also just recessionary fears as well, which is, I think, inevitable. You know, you've got lots of negatives at the moment. The negatives outweigh the ability of fiscal stimulus to ride through it. Well, in my view, but I've been saying that for 3 years, so maybe not.
So what's your outlook then? Is it sort of like for the smaller microcap sectors for sort of next year? I mean, obviously you're positive about your stocks, and we'll go into that in a moment, but just broadly in that sort of space.
I think it's been a tough place to be for a number of reasons, not just a kind of value bias. The Woodford effect had far more of a kind of sentiment implication than I probably would have thought. And I think, if I'm being honest, MiFID also had a negative impact too. So you've had those two collide at the same time, and at the same time, value being out of favour. So there's a real fear of liquidity from an investor base. So if you like, our investor base, especially in open-ended funds. So we've had to change our spots a little bit there. But actually, that's why having an investment trust, a closed-end vehicle, is absolutely ideal for this space. So actually, what I think you'll see is people realizing that buying something on a crazy multiple with an expectation of growth is fine with a certain part of their portfolio. But I think more and more so, we're finding that investors in our funds are looking for alternatives, if you like, to that kind of market trade at the moment. And therefore, I'm maybe be a little bit hopeful, but the interest that is being shown, I think, means that there will be more money coming into the microcap space, which will help on that liquidity point. And also, I think, really importantly, the retail investor, the professional investor, individual investor is really much more important to the space than ever before, which is why companies like Primary Bid are quite important when it comes to fundraisings. And I think making sure that the retail investor has a voice in companies, in these little microcap companies, is actually going to be a great trigger to help create liquidity as well. So, I mean, there's a lot to be fearful of. But at the same time, if you're buying companies that are reasonable quality, cheap, good management teams, and you're helping liquidity into the market, then actually it's going to be a nice place to be in the next 5 years, through the next 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm totally with you. It could be. I'm hoping it's going to be a bit sooner than that. I mean, my sort of thesis is that we're going to get a vaccine. So once we're actually through the COVID valley, I'm hoping the second half of 2021, we'll start seeing real earnings for a lot of those companies, the value stocks. And then you'll, if the share price stays where it is and the earnings return to what they were in 2019, I mean, the multiple goes from sort of ridiculously low to 8 to ridiculously low, about 4. and that should drive share prices higher in theory anyway.
Yeah, and I don't think, I mean, we're not betting so much on even a market return. You know, we're not betting the multiple going from 4 to 8 or from 8 to 12. Actually, we can get it right with the underlying businesses and get their earnings going. And actually, our businesses have fared an awful lot better through the COVID situation than we thought. You know, real credit to those management teams. And I do think, as you say, you return to some form of normality, whatever that is. And then actually, you know, you can get those earnings kicking through. And then, of course, you get the double whammy, double impact of market re-rating as well. You know, these stocks are not expensive. And you're not buying them with I think, inherent risk, because a lot of them have managed to trade their way through COVID. And that's no mean feat.
So just running through a few specifics, so obviously you've got a fairly concentrated portfolio of about sort of 12 stocks in the investment trust. What are your, it's difficult because you obviously own all of them in big pieces and stuff. What would be sort of like the things that should investors just run the slide rule over at the moment?
Yeah, I think so. First of all, I'll tell you what we've been doing in the portfolio over the last sort of 6 or 7 months or so. We're quite defensive. Our cash levels are quite high. We've been taking profits in a couple of positions, and we have said farewell to a couple of things as well. We're not so much that the investment case has changed and our belief in the company, it's just, I think, going to take longer to play out. And we have, through COVID, we've introduced two new positions that we will talk about in due course, but can't talk about just yet because we're still adding to them. But they're slightly different. One is, I think, really well priced company in the healthcare and wellbeing space, which is diversifying the portfolio a little bit. And another one is in that consumer space as well, not high street consumer. Both little minnows, both nice little companies that are probably underneath the radar, names that you might not have heard of. So in due course, we'll talk about those. And actually, we're in the process of adding another one as well. So meanwhile, in the portfolio, what do I get despondent about? You know, companies like Adept Technologies, companies that have got reoccurring revenue, 3-5 year reoccurring revenue, in a space that is, you know, highly geared to the Teams meetings and Zoom meetings.
They do IT setup for offices and schools.
Yeah, it's not the setup, it's the full service element. Yeah. So everything from your iPhone agreements right the way through to your network.
One-stop shop for IT and telecommunications.
Yeah, one-stop shop. Yeah, and it's not just for SMEs, they do it for government, local authorities, schools. So, you know, these are good. It's not a high-risk SME.
Do they fit out homes at all? Can I order them to come and do mine?
we can't, but unsurprisingly, I have asked them a couple of times when I've had a few IT issues, but you're not supposed to do that, apparently. So, you know, they've got recurring revenues. I think the reason that they are probably a little bit unloved by the market is that they've been really acquisitive over the years, and they've actually, if you look at their acquisition track record, they've really hit the nail on the head when it comes to getting earnings from immediate earnings from these deals, but their debt levels have kind of fluctuated a little bit.
Right.
And my advice to them was that actually, if you just stand still for 5 minutes and let the cash flow come through, people will believe your earnings and they won't be worried about debt levels. And I think, and not that debt levels are high by any means, but I think probably making sure that there's no indigestion in that deal flow pipeline, showing investors that they can de-gear, is a good thing. And actually, that's kind of COVID letting them do that.
Yeah.
So that's one that I think is looking stupidly cheap.
I see the biggest book position is Volex, which has actually done very well, but you've been trimming it. Is that because of the sort of size position? Just got it too big in your portfolio?
Purely portfolio management. It's still one of our largest conviction positions, and we believe one of the cheapest. And now, you know, got quality. When we invested in it, I think probably about 4 years ago we first invested in it. It was a company that had come through turnaround with a relatively new management team, and they've done pretty much everything that they said they were going to do and have been very, very good at acquisitions. And it's
Darren Morris, is it?
Yeah.
I remember looking at it a few years ago and thinking this is a low value cable manufacturer, and they're now hitting 8% EBIT margins. How have they done that? Putting real value into a sort of like a value chain that doesn't seem to doesn't seem to have any.
Well, I mean, it's a bit of a real kind of zero to hero story to a certain extent. I mean, if you looked at Rolex over the last, I think, 10 years, I think it might have had 6 management teams. I'm maybe exaggerating, but it's roughly that number. And, you know, they had gone, historically, management teams have gone into loss-making contracts like the Apple cables and chargers and things like that. And Nat and Darren came in, saw the opportunity as much from the sector as anything else, where we've got lots of little fragmented players that would be sitting beside larger OEMs geographically, but with no economies of scale. And frankly, it was a business that wasn't that well run. So therefore, they took costs out of the business, made it much more efficient, but then actually set about creating that scale and the operational gearing and going into not, you know, just horrible commodity cables, but going into CT scanners and MRI scanners, real sort of higher value. So, that's how the margins change, and they'll continue to do that.
Absolutely phenomenal turnaround in terms of value, you know, accretion, not only for shareholders, but for customers as well. Another one which is quite an interesting one is Synetics, because that used to be sort of like an old surveillance business that did casinos, I believe, and buses. But now with the sort of the COVID pandemic, there's lots of opportunity for surveillance, as much for public health as there is for sort of like, you know, new people wanting to make sure that people are social distancing and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, this is a business, and I know they won't be embarrassed about me saying this, but has in the past been quite sleepy. It was a business called Quadnetics, if you go back.
Oh, yes, 20 years ago, Quadnetics. Yep,
that's the one. So I think when I pitched up at their door, observing what you've just talked about from a macro dynamic point of view, and it's a lovely little cash generative company, don't get me wrong, you know, the metrics look nice. It wasn't something that needed a wholesale kind of restructure or anything like that. But I just felt that, you know, there probably was an opportunity out there that the management team were starting to take, but maybe just needed a little bit of help and energy behind it. In fairness, they created a new board appointment, and that's somebody that's got a great tech background. Yeah. And the real investment case here is moving from that box sale, as you say, to a casino or an oil field, to something that's much more now called command and control. So basically a whole command and control centre that's got software within it that allows switching on and off of cameras, face ID, all the dynamics that you talk about. And so they're moving from what might be a nice, quite pedestrian sort of mid-20s margin into this kind of command and control side where you're capable of generating sort of 30-40% margins.
Because of the scale benefits.
And they do need operational scale there.
Yeah.
And I think from a market point of view, a sector point of view, and this is going back to what we identified at the start and maybe about 3 years ago, and that is absolutely right for consolidation. And Motorola has been going around hoovering up 2 or 3 little companies, and one of them actually Indigo Vision, which was the other kind of quoted company in this space. And I'm not saying that, you know, we'd even think about being a seller to Motorola, but it shows that the value added within now much more of a software solutions solution is is being appreciated, and it's a market that's growing, and it's not going to. And in fairness, they're doing well on buses and other stuff like that, but it's not. It's far more within UK infrastructure, and in fact, infrastructure worldwide. One of the big contracts that they won about a year ago is with Deutsche Bahn for their rail network and their railway network, which is obviously quite significant. It was a 9 million euro contract, and I think it's expanded out quite a bit. So that's a solution sale.
I remember looking at it, and I know the software. I was always impressed with the quality of the intelligence behind it. And when you're selling into mission critical applications, I mean, these are going to have quadruple 9 uptime and absolutely be perfect and so secure that allows you to get the margins that, say, a Zoom video can't, you know, when you're selling to the consumers. Well, I'm just going back to the coming full circle as much. Anyway, you talked about you know, potential recessionary risk. I see you've Ramsden's Holdings there. Isn't that a pawnbroker? I mean, that would be a perfect play, you would have thought, even though the shops, I guess, have been closed.
Yeah, so it was the only one within our portfolio where there was, in lockdown, I think there were about 98% furloughed. What do you like about that one? Well, you're right. You know, there's pawnbroking. There's an element of the business. There's also quite a high element of ethics. It's maybe quite interesting at the moment as well. But they've got the whole gold reserves. They've got net cash in the balance sheet. And actually, it's one of probably the best run little companies I've come across in that retail space.
Is it a good time to sell that gold, though? I mean, you're going to get...
No, they're not. No, absolutely no. They're holding on to it. So they don't need it. They've got cash reserves. Their shops are open. And, you know, dare I say it, I think, you know, consumer is going to...
roll
if
over.
If we do go into recession, it's going to be a tough place to be. And, you know, the pawnbroking side is going to do well. And FX, when we are ever finally allowed to travel again, that's an area of the market that has been pretty good for them. Because of the demographic that they're in. So yeah, we think it's pretty cheap. You know, anything below 130 looks stupid, really.
Yeah, no, it looks good value. And the last one, which just go quickly, Hargreaves Services. Now that is a land play. I mean, presumably, or a property play, and that's presumably the thesis such that a lot of these economists have been saying the housing market's going to go down by 7%. But for defying gravity, house prices have actually gone up by 3%. And you look at the US as a sort of like a movie of what could happen here, and the house prices have gone up by 10, 15, 20%. So land doesn't seem to be decreasing in value. And presumably these guys are going to benefit from that. If that's the case, you do get asset inflation rather than CPI inflation.
Yeah, we think we're buying it at 56% discount to, you know, a prudent NAV. Which is quite difficult to get. So, you know, we've got a decent margin of safety there. I think, and there's a couple of other elements too. There's optionality because, I don't know if you've seen, but they've got a German operation in the energy space that they bought into about 2 years ago. Mm. And I think strategically there's something to do there at the right time as well. So you've got that land bank, you've got the other operations that are not geared towards property, and you've got a NAV play. And it's quite nice to be in good company there. So, a strategic investor who I admire a lot, Chris Mills.
Okay, yes.
He's now got 27 or 28% of it.
Yeah, okay.
So he was building a stake round about the same time as we were. So, you know, we shared our investment cases and what the end outcome might be.
Yeah.
But Chris is not going to sit there and just use it as a yield play for the next 5 years. So, there's definitely something to be done there. The course of it. It's difficult to say the time frame for that playing out, but we know it will play out.
Yeah. And then just sort of like, you know, again, top level, when you select sort of value plays, the thing I have a lot of problems with, and I know investors do as well, is what's the difference between a value investment and a value trap?
Yeah.
How do you distinguish between that? I mean, higher dividend? A bit of a giveaway?
No, I think I haven't learned the lesson. I've been in a few value traps in the time. So I think for us, and we're maybe slightly different because we can take these strategic stakes. So it's about having optionality. It's about making sure you've got those catalysts and not pretending that you've got them. You know, actually seeing that in Synectics there might be industry consolidation, so they can be a consolidator or consolidated. At the same time, you've got a nice business underneath. In Hargreaves, you've got the optionality of disposal of certain parts of the business ultimately. But you know, you can sit and look at those things on paper and have a little bit of a tick list. But for us, we've got to know that we've got the ability to help drive those catalysts and actually have a management team that is aligned and actually wants to drive those catalysts along with us. And they're not just there for a job for the boys, not just there to pick up a paycheck. So being allowed and being able to incentivize management teams to have that same shareholder realization goal is really important for us. I think where we've got it wrong in the past is where we thought we maybe had one catalyst and we had a little bit of influence, and actually you might not have one of those or either of those, and then you're sitting there in a value trap. And then that's uncomfortable. In those situations, we tend to just, you know, cut and run.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Judith, for your time. That's been absolutely brilliant. I'm going to take solace in that case because my portfolio has got red all over it this year. It's been a real a real sort of like, you know, struggle. But just before we sort of finish, where would be the best place if somebody wants to invest in Downing? Is it best to sort of just go on the website or to contact you or somebody to if they're interested?
I'm always keen to speak to investors. Our investment trust that has been through the depths of the J curve, sitting on a 20-something percent discount at the moment. So you're getting a nice double discount. So that's quite an attractive thing to look at. I think, sadly, microcap might be out of favour for a little bit of time yet. So, you know, you have to be prepared to weather the bad with the good. But if you believe in this value space and strategic investing, then it's now's quite a time to be looking at us and other strategic investment trusts as well.
Brilliant. Well, thanks very much, Judith.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.